Good morning. You're listening to KUNV 91.5, and this is Neon Eden. I'm your host, J. Patrick Kulikin. You can read my columns in the Las Vegas Sun and Las Vegas Weekly. My co-host, as always, Las Vegas Sun reporter Tovin LePan. Happy Independence Day, and what better topic on this holiday than sickness and health? After last week's Supreme Court decision upholding the constitutionality of Obamacare, we decided we would revisit the law and talk a bit about the American healthcare system and how the new law will affect it. Joining us today is Chris Cochran, Associate Professor of Healthcare Administration and Policy at UNLV. Professor Cochran, thanks for joining us.
Happy to be here.
Now, forgive us, Professor Cochran, but we really want to boil down healthcare, complex as this subject is. So let's just start with the basics. Describe for us, as best you can, our healthcare system as is and its financing. How do various people, various Americans, get their health care?
Well, that's a pretty good question to start out with, and it's a pretty long answer, but I'll try to shorten it up. Most Americans receive their health care through their employer, and I would say most Americans under the age of 65, non-elderly Americans, most of them get it through their employer.
Roughly what portion?
We're talking about 30% of Americans are covered under employment sponsored health care.
Okay.
A significant number of Americans receive their health care from the government. In fact, the government is the biggest provider of health care in the U.S., of health insurance in the country, because you've got Medicare and Medicaid. So, you know, when we talk about, for example, people
and,
who...
And let's just, we'll break those out. Medicare is for Americans
65 and over.
Uh-huh.
And
that's
and,
a...
And the disabled.
Okay. And Medicare is a single-payer insurance.
It's a single-payer insurance.
Much like the Canadian system.
Correct, correct. I was going to mention that. If you talked about whether or not we have a single-payer system in the U.S., we do, and it's called Medicare. There are different ways of obtaining your... different forms of Medicare that will pay for it. You can have a regular fee-for-service type plan, the more traditional type, and there are also these managed care plans that are available that provide incentives for folks to use the managed care to get their enrollment in that plan. And then we have Medicaid. And Medicaid is a federally funded plan that provides health insurance primarily to women and children who are 100% of poverty. And that is a state and federal plan. So states buy into the plan. They help pay for it. It's a significant burden on states, I have to say, you know, because states have mandates in which they must operate under a budget that they cannot, you know, they cannot exceed their budget allocation. So it makes it difficult for states when the cost of health care goes up and then potentially when the cost of Medicaid, operating Medicaid, goes up. But it is a federal and state plan. You could look at it and you could say there are 50 different insurance plans under Medicaid because some states contribute more to purchase Medicaid so that they can expand it more and provide it to more people.
In the case of Nevada, my understanding is we have a thriftier plan, which means less money.
It means less money. The state
from the federal government.
Correct. Correct. So the match that we put up doesn't attract as much money to Nevada as it could.
Now, clearly, when you say employer-based coverage, Medicare, Medicaid, a bunch of people are falling through the cracks.
Well, we've got 21% of Nevada's population is uninsured, and we're approaching 20% around the country. So that's a significant number if you think one in five people don't have health care insurance.
How did they get their health care?
They either pay for it out of pocket if they've got the resources to do it, or they oftentimes wait until they're too sick and they go to an emergency room of a hospital. All hospitals must see a patient if they've got an emergency type situation. But typically this falls then on the public hospitals, where a lot of folks will go, say, such as UMC.
And so what are the, you know, the specific problems with this system in terms of cost and access? And is it an issue of just it's too expensive, they can raise the rate so high that people with, you know, pre-existing conditions can't purchase it? Or is there a lack of access and just ability to find insurance and sift through the system and find a plan that works for you?
Well, insurance is going to be high no matter whether you're healthy or not. And certainly it's going to be higher. If you have to buy it in the market, if you've got a pre-existing condition, it's going to be a higher cost to an individual. Otherwise, individuals would have to pay for their health care out of pocket. Now, the typical plan for an individual is going to run anywhere from $5,000 to $6,000 a year, depending on your health status. The older you are, obviously, it may be more expensive because as we get older, we start to see more healthcare conditions that affect us. For a family, it could be as much as $14,000 to $15,000 a year in the private market. Again, it's going to depend on the type of plan that you have. So you can buy, for example, what would be considered a catastrophic plan, which would cost less money, but you're going to pay a significant amount of money out of pocket before you meet that what's called the catastrophic.
It's designed only to care for you in a catastrophic situation.
Correct.
Right. Okay.
Correct.
So that, so obviously what you're outlining there is the obstacles to access to care. American healthcare is extraordinarily expensive and getting more so. Talk about that a little.
Well, let's take the cost of healthcare has been one of the big problems. We have, since I started in as a professor in healthcare administration, when I was a graduate student, I point out we had 33 million uninsured Americans. This was in the mid 90s. Okay, we now have about 50 million uninsured Americans.
Mm-hmm. Faster than the increase in population.
Correct. Yeah. And one of the problems that has happened is that, you know, even though employers will offer health care insurance to their employees, oftentimes because of the cost, the employees have to assume a certain burden of that cost. And in some cases have to assume all the burden, but because they're a member of they've got a large group, the cost could be significantly reduced. You'll see frequently, though, where the employee, him or herself, will be covered by the insurance plan, but they have to purchase in the family portion if they're going to cover their spouse and children. So that becomes more expensive for the individuals. As the cost of health care have gone up, and they go up every single year.
Why?
All sorts of different factors, technology being a major portion of it, and also
new and expensive
procedures, technology, and tests. All of those things contribute to the increasing cost. The resources needed, you know, the professional resources needed to operate a healthcare system. They're highly paid individuals. The cost goes up on average about 5% a year, which, again, exceeds GDP growth, if you mm-hmm. think about it. So the cost of healthcare goes up faster than GDP. So when employers then look at this in terms of the burden that it's going to put on them to cover their employees, they have shifted more of that burden to individual employees. And employees then oftentimes opt out. They say, I can't afford this anymore. I need to pay, especially in a deep recession like we're in, and the recession has certainly affected healthcare coverage. So in a deep recession, people are going to say, I have to pay for shelter and food. You know, they're going to go for those immediate needs before they're going to purchase something where they say, you know, I hope I don't get sick. You know, and that's one of the unfortunate things about healthcare in this country is that in dire economic situations like we faced for the last 4 years, we're one of the few countries where the individual then also has to worry about their health care, not just about whether or not they've got the resources to take care of their families or themselves, but they have to decide whether they've got the cost to cover their own health care.
Let's talk about, you mentioned we're one of the few countries where that's the case. Talk about other advanced industrialized nations. How do they provide health care?
Most countries either provide healthcare. There are different types of systems where you've got where the country itself, the state itself, will provide the healthcare resources, including paying physicians and running the hospitals.
True socialized medicine.
True socialized medicine.
The UK would be
UK would is a perfect example of that. You've got a system like Canada, which is a single payer system. The providers, the hospitals, then the physicians, they are private groups. But they are paid by a single payer.
The insurance is run socialized.
By the state, right. Correct. Then you've got situations like in Germany where you've got a combination, where the federal, where the government and employers work together to provide insurance for their employees. A similar situation in France. But overall, of the industrialized nations, the United States is, I believe, the only country that doesn't have a dominant government involvement, I should say, in delivery of health care. Mm-hmm. There is one other point that I would like to make regard, and because you mentioned socialized medicine, okay, and that's been a big concern. Americans say, keep the government out of my health care. But interestingly enough, the largest country in the world, China, is moving to a market-based healthcare system like the United States.
Huh. and obviously the government is deeply involved in a lot of people's healthcare, as you said, Medicaid, Medicare, they're covering.
Right,
more
exactly.
Than
I mean,
else.
The government is still there. Like kids, in Nevada can get through Nevada Checkup,
right,
which is an expanded version of Medicaid to get more kids covered. So while the parents may not qualify for Medicaid, the children do qualify under the Children's Health Insurance Program.
And speaking of Nevada, and you mentioned 21% of Nevadans are uninsured, and what are the how does Nevada do in comparison to other states and other healthcare indicators?
Well, Nevada's typically say this: Nevada's at the top of everything that's bad and at the bottom of everything that's good when
right.
it comes to healthcare. Because we do have a lot of riskier behaviors here. And in fact, for a while, that was presumed to be one of the reasons why insurers didn't want to move into Nevada, because there was a lot of risky behavior.
Higher rates of smoking,
you've got
alcohol
consumption, all of those things make you a riskier individual to insure.
Much more fun.
I can't deny
insurers aren't after
that's,
that.
That's right. But you have to, you have to be responsible. If you want to have all that fun, it would be nice if you get sick or you get hurt or, that you can pay for it without having to go and put the tax burden on local taxpayers through, say, the public hospital. Mm-hmm. But I don't know if I fully answered your questions. You were wondering in terms of how we rate health.
Overall health.
I mean, we have one of the highest rates of smoking in the country. We're about average in things like breast cancer. We are below average in coverage to low-income children. And we are also underserved in terms of providers. We don't have as many providers out here per capita as other states do. So that also creates an access burden on the population.
Okay, so I think we've skimmed the surface of the status quo. Now let's turn to Obamacare. Give us the main features of the law.
Well, the law was really, I point out that the law was more health insurance reform than it was health care reform.
Mm-hmm.
There are places within the law that are intended to help drive down the cost of healthcare. But generally speaking, the law was put in place to primarily to help those individuals who don't have health insurance. And one way of doing that was to provide a mandate so that individuals, there's been this concern that we have a free rider system here where individuals don't purchase healthcare, and then when they need it, the burden is shifted to other individuals to help pay for it, even though many of these folks may have had the ability to purchase health care. So we're now putting a system in place where individuals will be mandated to have health care.
And let me break in.
Sure.
That idea arose from conservative think tanks, I think beginning in 1989. The idea was it was a personal responsibility measure, that if you can pay for health insurance, you should, because otherwise, if you get sick, the rest of us have to pay for it.
Absolutely. And it's funny, because Obama was initially against a mandate when
right.
he was running for president. But he saw this really, and Hillary Clinton, who was his main opponent mm-hmm. at that time, favored a mandate.
Right.
And it became pretty clear that unless we could do something about this, what could be, referred to as this free rider system of care that we had, that we were still going to have a significant number of uninsured people out there. But we also have a large, and this is where the plan really kicks in, there are those folks for whom purchasing health care is so expensive, purchasing health insurance is so expensive that there needed to be something in place to help them get access to care.
Because they're already sick?
Well, not just because they're already sick, although that's an excellent point, because the health care mandate did say that you could not exclude people with pre-existing conditions.
Mm-hmm.
HIPAA was supposed to take care of that in some respects, but by allowing people to, say, change jobs in order, you know, even though they may have had pre-existing conditions. But even under that plan, they were then required to wait a period of time before they qualified for the new employer's health plan, which if you got a chronic illness, that may not be an option for
right.
you. So you stay in your place. So in this case, what they're saying is, no, you have to cover people if they've got pre-existing conditions. So that's one issue. Mm-hmm.
But then the trade-off was, okay, you're now forced to cover somebody who has diabetes, but in exchange for that, I mean, maybe that's it wasn't quite so explicit, but I think we all know that was the exchange was we're going to deliver a bunch of new customers to you, and those customers are likely to be younger and healthier.
Younger and healthier customers, exactly.
And that's going to drive
down
the risk.
And that's going to drive down the risk, exactly. Yeah. So the bigger the pool, the lower the risk. That's why, for example, in Canada, a single-payer system is attractive, because Canada doesn't have nearly as many people as we have in the United States. So, you know, the larger the pool, you spread that risk out among a large group of people. Mm-hmm. So the bigger the pool, the lower the risk. And we also had a large number of healthy young adults who were not purchasing insurance, in part still, though, because of the cost. Because let's face it, you're breaking into your professional life.
Mm-hmm.
You're not making necessarily as much as you're going to make in the future.
Mm-hmm.
And you're going to make a decision between what is it that I want to do with the money that I'm making. Do I want to buy insurance?
Or take a trip to Vegas.
Or take a trip to Vegas. Well, and you know what? And since we're in those age groups, you know, say 18 to 30, bulletproof in general,
right?
The chances are that that they're going to opt for that route. So then the plan now offers individuals to cover their children in their own healthcare plan up to age 26,
so
which
these
is
young,
very popular.
Right, these younger, healthier folks, they can stay
their
on their
parents' plan.
Although, but they still have the mandate applies to them.
It still applies to them if uh-huh. they choose not to be covered under the parents' plan.
They'll be taxed.
They will be taxed.
Or penalized,
right.
However you want to look at it. So that increased coverage. We've also expanded Medicaid, right?
We've expanded The federal government has proposed to expand Medicaid, and initially that was going to be for all the states. And
mm-hmm.
some states were going to get free coverage. You know, this was the what they referred to as the Cornhusker kickback
right.
To allow Nebraska and I think Louisiana and Florida, two of the states that really pushed against the Obamacare mandate.
Those were stripped out of the final
they
bill,
were,
I think.
They
I
were stripped
think, yeah.
out, yeah.
Okay.
But they had to be so the states were going to expand Medicaid and the federal government was going to pick up the cost of it until 2017, and then the state's contribution to it would be phased in over a period of a few years,
mm-hmm.
up to no more than 10% of the total cost of the expansion. But that would cover people up to 133% poverty, or approximately 16 million Americans. So it was not an insignificant number of people who were mm-hmm. going to be covered under this mandate.
And the court has ruled that the federal government cannot force the states to accept that Medicaid expansion, and so we'll see some states will apparently...
Some states will take their time in
or
opting...
Or not take it at all.
Or not take it at all. I would be surprised if eventually every state did not participate in it anyway. We saw the last two states who didn't participate in Medicaid, that was Arizona and Alaska, opt into Medicaid just a few years ago. They did not accept Medicaid dollars. They did not contribute to Medicaid, and they did not accept Medicaid dollars.
For decades.
For decades, when Medicaid first kicked in.
Okay.
And so now they
do. To the more libertarian states in the union.
Absolutely.
And they eventually decided to take to join the Medicaid
because
program.
It was cheaper. Let's face
okay.
it. You're going to get a significant portion.
You're just treating these people in emergency rooms and
right. If
okay.
they don't have insurance, you know, and so that's a big problem was a big problem.
So
for
they joined Medicaid and by your lights, these states that are claiming that they're not going to join the Medicaid expansion will eventually.
They're going to have a lot of pressure to join, uh-huh. not just from individuals and
But from healthcare providers.
But from healthcare providers, okay. Because those healthcare providers are still going to be providing that care.
Uncompensated care.
Yeah.
Free care, basically.
Exactly. Okay. And, you know, I mean, people may get billed for it, but if you don't have the money, you're not going to pay it. And so the providers are going to be on the hook for this. And those people are still going to face the situation that we have right now, which is they put off care, they're sicker patients, it becomes more expensive to treat them.
And let's talk a little bit about the costs overall for the program. I mean, there's been a lot of things thrown out there, and I even wanted to read one quote from the presumptive Republican nominee, Mitt Romney, that he said, this was right after the Supreme Court's decision on Thursday. He said, Obamacare raises taxes on the American people by approximately $500 billion. Obamacare cuts Medicare by approximately $500 billion. And he adds that it adds trillions to our deficits and to our national debt. And at the same time, the Congressional Budget Office, which reviews policies like this to see potential costs or savings, it said that it should save $124 billion over 10 years. And then in 2011, when the Republicans offered a bill to repeal the healthcare law, at that time they estimated that it would actually add, the repeal would have added $210 billion over 10 years. So the numbers change, vary a little bit, but one side saying it's adding, you know, trillions to the deficit, one side saying that it would save the money, or the Congressional Budget Office really is saying it saves money, and I'm sure the Obama administration would point to the Congressional Budget Office. And do you have a handle on which way this is really going? I mean, those are two pretty varied numbers.
Well, it's probably somewhere in the middle. You know, I think that overall, over time, it should save money because as we're seeing, for example, the Obamacare is also going to require insurance providers to provide preventative health care. And this is something new. You know, it was oftentimes that health insurance would provide for your acute care needs, but the preventative stuff was oftentimes paid out of pocket. Kind of different than, say, in the compare it to dentistry, for example, where if you have dental coverage, typically what you're getting under dental coverage is you're getting the preventative stuff. You're getting the cleanings and the fillings and things like that. But the expensive stuff, the extractions and root canals and crowns and things of that nature aren't covered under most insurance plans. And so you're paying for the high cost.
Why is that? Why would dental and medical plans be so different that way?
Because more people are going to need the preventative thing is something that more people are going to have. And, you know, and if we could get more people to use the dental prevention stuff, if people are, you know, seeing fewer cavities, et cetera, they're probably better off in getting paid for insurance for the preventative stuff than you may see fewer. You know.
But why has traditional health insurance been resistant to paying for preventative care if that could help them, if that would prevent them from having to make these large payments for chronic illness down the road?
Well, that's a good question. Now, some of the things that we're talking about, though, are things that are being provided that people have to have. For example, immunizations for kids. If you want to go to school, you have to have all your immunizations done. So these are the kind of preventative things that we traditionally did and paid for through our primary care provider. But some of these other activities that we could see to reduce, say, chronic illnesses, catching them earlier to prevent the development of chronic illnesses, that's the kind of preventative care that we're really looking at under this insurance. Because the drivers of reimbursement are going to be those things that are more expensive to provide care for, and we have a market-based healthcare system in the United States, and you know, if people are all healthy, you know, we're going to face the possibility of, you know, some institutions not earning as much as they would. But, you know, bottom line is, eventually we all get sick.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Eventually, we all get sick, and we all need some sort of health care. We can't live forever.
You mentioned preventive care. I mean, what else is in place to help drive down or to attempt to drive down the cost of health care, which has seen really runaway inflation?
Well, there are going to be, for example, not just the preventative care, but if we can capture or reduce chronic care, because chronic care is really has become one of the most expensive drivers of chronic illness, has become most one of the most expensive drivers of healthcare.
And what are we talking about? Diabetes?
Talking about diabetes, heart disease, anything that lasts over 60 days is considered to be a chronic illness. Mm-hmm. But you have people living with certain diseases, you know, and you know, we have the opportunity, we have this huge epidemic of obesity in this country. That leads to chronic disease, so we can put in place, some of these plans may put in place programs that would help reduce obesity, you know, and there are going to be all sorts of grants and things like that offered that would also help in that regard.
What about, my understanding is that we're spending a tremendous amount of our healthcare dollars on a very small patient pool.
That's right.
Is it, I mean, something like 40%, pay for 5%, or
It goes back and forth. I think we're at the 15-85 rule.
15% of patients 15,
yeah,
absorb
we pay
85%
of the cost.
Okay. And a lot of that, I also understand, is in the last 6 months of people's lives.
That's a significant amount of it. It's certainly in the older age groups.
Mm-hmm. Does Obamacare do anything about that?
Well, one of the things that Obamacare was looking at trying to do was to provide counseling for individuals about getting them to realize their, you know, what things like advanced directives. Uh-huh. You know, what do you want to do?
Death panels.
They weren't death panels. Uh-huh. They were, you know, right. And that's what they
getting
were
people
referring
to. Have the conversation.
Have the conversation.
Right.
You know, I deal with that currently, you know. I have a mother who's 89 years old, and she is experiencing more and more healthcare problems. You know, and these are conversations that people need to have. How much intervention do you want? And without that conversation, the healthcare providers are going to err on the side of the patient. They're going to provide that care.
That's in the culture of healthcare.
It's in the culture of healthcare.
Save at all costs.
If the patient didn't say no, then they're going to do what they can to save the patient, regardless of age, regardless of their disease condition.
Mm-hmm. Well, on that note, this has been a great discussion, but I'm afraid we could probably talk for several more hours. And if you will be willing, we'd love to have you back again to discuss this further.
I'd be happy to talk with you again.
Well, we'd like to thank Chris Cochran. He's an associate professor of healthcare administration and policy at UNLV. You've been listening to Neon Eden on KUNV 91.5. I'm J. Patrick Kulik and my co-host, Tovin Lepan. See you next week.